So many of you were at the AMP conference, and so many of you also joined us for our base camp celebration at Reasons to Believe. I'm going to invite any one of you that are at the conference just to come up here and just share your experiences. I was kind of off in the corner, so I didn't get to see a lot of what was happening. So I just appreciate just hearing what your perspectives were. So, yeah, why don't you come up? And we got a microphone here for you somewhere, so let's pull that up here for you. Okay.
Hello. Okay. Yeah, there was probably 10 of us there from this class yesterday. Here's the brochure to prove that it's real. And there were 10 speakers, really good people, four RTB speakers. And the theme of the conference, the theme verse was 1 Peter 3:15. I'll read it real quick. But in your heart, set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you, to give the reason for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and respect. So that's all the speakers kind of glommed onto that and gave their specialty. To me, it was different than our class here. It's apologetics, but it was a lot of philosophical side of apologetics. So I think there's going to be recordings available.
There are recordings.
Yeah, so I really recommend it. And, you know, I'll just mention one of the speakers. They were all great. But I'll mention the last guy, Abdu Murray. He's a Lebanese. He was a Muslim, but he converted to Christianity. He's a lawyer, real bright guy. So he analyzes things, kind of like you. He had to analyze things to really find God. And so he trusted the Quran. He still does, in a way. But Islam has three different books he mentioned. They have the Quran, which he said is not really... The older ones aren't corrupt, but he says the newer ones are. And two other books that Muslims use, and I can't remember the names of them.
The Hadith.
Okay. And so he said the Quran, he read about the Gospels in there, especially in the early books of the Bible. And the Quran lifts them up and says they're correct. And yet these other books that the Muslims use say that all of the Bible is corrupted. So he saw this contradiction. And that got him thinking. And then he started really digging into it. And he finally realized that Islam does have a lot of corruption in it. And he still did not put down the Quran, though. He thinks that it's not, except for the newer versions. He knows there's other versions that are corrupted. It was the other books that he said contradicted the Quran and the Bible. So that was what got him to thinking and what got him to move into Christianity. Well, that's just one of the speakers.
Okay, you want to come up?
There are a lot of really good people, but one thing that really stuck out to me was the guy John Dickerson was talking about that everybody has been given a sphere of influence or a tribe where you are the missionary. And so that we need to be intentional about going after our tribe, our sphere of influence. And so it's like, I just came up with ideas like, hey, I'm going to do an evangelistic yard sale and get to know my neighbors better. I mean, they don't have to know that I just want to do that so that I'll get to know them and get to know their names and know about them and, you know, be able to say that I'll pray for them and stuff. But I thought it was kind of neat about, you know, being intentional about. And then Jeff Vine was talking about don't separate, which is what I keep hearing a lot from Ross. Do not separate and isolate yourselves in your little Christian cocoon. And do not assimilate, but rather permeate.
Okay, anybody else?
I have a question.
Yes.
Now, maybe I missed something, but from the former Muslim gentleman, I didn't get the impression that he still held the Quran up in any way, shape, or form. So, did I miss something?
Yeah, he was telling his story about, you know, where he reached a point in his life where he was kind of trying to hold both books
right.
as being valid, trying to keep his Islamic faith, but also adopt the Christian faith, and recognize that that couldn't be done. And so that's when he said he completely broke off from the Islam, realized that Christianity was the way to go. But Abdu Muri's passion is to equip Christians to effectively reach out to Muslims. Basically saying, you know, you need to learn their culture, what not to do and what to do. And that if you're sensitive as to how to approach it, you can really have success in leading large numbers of Muslims to Christ. And, you know, we got to talk to Abdu a little bit. You know, he actually spent time at Reasons to Believe as a visiting scholar. And just how eerie it is, how similar Islam is to Mormonism. You know, they both have a Latter-day Prophet. They both have Latter-day books that add to the Old New Testament. They both, quote, endorse the Old New Testament, but in both religions, they try to destroy the people's confidence in the Old New Testament and get them focusing on these latter books. Both Muhammad and Joseph Smith, quote, had an angel visit them with a revelation. And as you read through the books, the doctrines are virtually identical. Both religions have a very similar doctrine of how women are to be treated within the community. Very similar doctrine of what heaven is like. They both deny the Trinity. One's polytheistic, one's monotheistic, but they are united in denying the Trinity. So, and it got us thinking, too. One way to identify a non-Christian religion or a Christian cult. Every cult, every non-Christian religion denies the Trinity. Every one of them demeans women. I don't know why women would be attracted to some of these faiths. And then every one of them has a distorted view of heaven. Heaven is always something we can visualize and imagine, rather than we see in Scripture, where it's beyond what any one of us can think or imagine. Where it's not part of our physics or our dimensions, it's beyond our physics and our dimensions. So it's kind of a way to, you know, determine, you know, which what is a cult and what is not a cult. So, yes.
Are you going to be able to make Abdu material available through RTV?
We already are. I mean, Fazrana, for example, did several video interviews of Abdu. It's already up on our website, where a lot of this material was discussed. And Abdu has formed his own organization. I'm trying to remember the name of it, something about the truth. He was with RZIM. He's now got his own organization. So. No, he lives in the Detroit area. So, but yeah, he's definitely a fan of Reasons to Believe. And as he shared his story yesterday, he actually described how there was two campus people at University of Michigan that he was trying to convert to Islam, and they were trying to convert him to Christianity, and how he basically said, well, how can you possibly be Christians when Genesis 1 is filled with all these problems? And he told the story of how these two guys said, well, we don't know about that, but they wound up giving them a video. And it was a message I gave at the University of Michigan on Genesis 1. So he actually says that was kind of his first inkling that maybe Christianity had something going for it after all. And so I asked Abdu when that happened, and then it was like 22 years ago. So, but he's a very skilled lawyer and is very good at what he does. And obviously an imposing figure. He's 6'9", so... Wait, so that really helped him in when he was a trial lawyer. I mean, so. But my perspective on the conference was, I think we tried something we've never tried before, which was limiting all these professional apologists to 30 minutes. And, I'm friends with a lot of these apologists. They all love to talk, and they're all aggressive talkers. And limiting it to 30 minutes, I think, was a good thing to do. So, now, the scientists on our side were all saying, you know, what can we say in just 30 minutes? And, you know, it was a strain for me to try to edit it down to 30 minutes. But I think it was good, because what we heard from people was, look, we're not scientists, and 30-minute segments is about all we can handle. So, and by the way, I thought Fuzz Rana gave the best message of his whole career. It was just an outstanding message. And he told me having to boil it down to 30 minutes, I think, really helped as well. So we will be doing it again, because we got 250 people that showed up at the door. I mean, we had 800 registrants at the time, and that was a little bit less than break-even. And we needed a break-even to do it again. But with those 250 registrants, of course, that meant we had to go out and buy 250 lunches on the spot. So that was a bit of a challenge, but we actually got the lunches delivered in time. So, and you're wondering why we charge a little bit extra for registering the door? That's why. Because you got to go out and get, you know, on-the-spot lunches for people. And so, but, yeah. I was thrilled with our staff, too. We had virtually our whole staff there at the AMP conference. And a lot of them are some of our newer employees. They'd never been to an event before. And, boy, just seeing what it did to them, they're just so excited. So that was fun for me. And I got to see a miracle while I was there, because, you know, I spoke Friday night. And the way we did it is, you know, we'd have three or four speakers in different segments. And then there'd be a panel discussion where people could ask questions. And so I was on a panel with a couple of pastors, and you know, I was a scientist, the others were philosopher types. And one of them got a question, what do you do with free will and predestination? Yeah. And if you were there, people said, we could tell by the look on your face that you're a little bit uncomfortable with the answer that was given. Because basically what the gentleman said is, well, I believe in foreknowledge, but not predestination. It's like, well, gee, what do you do with Ephesians? It says God foreknows and predetermines. I kept my mouth shut. And, you know, I realized, okay, each question is for one speaker only. But right on the spot, I prayed that I would get a question that would allow me a diplomatic segue to try to give some additional perspective on the question that was just posed. And the next question was an answer to my prayer that I just couldn't believe. A gentleman came to the microphone and says, Hugh, do you know anything about this problem that physicists discuss about information in black holes and entropy in black holes not being able to escape? And I says, Lord, you've answered my prayer right on the spot, literally within 1 minute. Because I was able to respond to, well, you know, I've actually addressed that in Chapter 3 of Beyond the Cosmos. And a whole lot of people went out, and we didn't have the book there. We had to go back and get a bunch because everybody wanted to see what I had to say there. But I said, you know, the resolution of the problem of black holes trapping all this entropy and information is resolved once we realize there's six small dimensions of space accompanying the three large dimensions. Because what it actually does is it sets up, you know, two boundaries for the black hole, two event horizons. With one event horizon, the information and the entropy can never escape. But if you've got two event horizons, it does escape and solves the problem. But only solves the problem if you've got these nine dimensions of space. And we now have evidence that these nine dimensions actually are real. And so I was able to use that as a segue. Likewise, once we realize that the universe has nine dimensions of space, and the space-time theorems tell us that the creator of the universe must have access to at least the equivalent of another dimension of time, we can now resolve the problem of predestination and free will. Mm-hmm. And so the problem is, in four dimensions of space and time, there is no resolution to divine predestination and human free will. But if you allow God to be as big as what the Bible tells us he must be, he transcends the dimensions he creates, and as big as what physics now proves it must be, there are multiple ways you can have human free will simultaneously operating with God predetermining every thought we think, every word we speak, and every action we perform from before the universe. By the way, that gentleman came up to me afterwards and said, I'd like you to talk in my church about how you resolve this problem. So he says, my main concern, he says, you know, I've had you speak in my church before, but my main fear of bringing reasons to believe speakers in is that they'll speak at such a high intellectual plateau and give out so much scientific data, it's going to, our congregation will be lost. Because he says, my church is a blue-collar church. I've been to his church. Yes, there are blue-collar people there, but there's a lot of people in the professions. But I think what was good for him, he got to see Fuzz and Jeff and me give 30-minute talks where the cookies were on the bottom shelf. And he says, yeah, we really need to bring reasons to believe into our church. And it's one of the fastest-growing churches here in Southern California.
What's the name of it?
Christ Church of the Valley.
So,
anyway, it's always a thrill for me to experience a miracle at an event like that. So, the fact that God answered the prayer that quickly and that dramatic. By the way, how often do I get a question about black holes and the entropy problem? I did get that once 4 years ago when I was on a university campus. I think it was when I was on the Rice University campus. But since then, it's never come up. And for some reason, I did wind up writing about 5 paragraphs on it in Beyond the Cosmos. So, God answers prayer. Yes?
How sure do you feel, I don't know how you measure this, but how sure do you feel about black, well, string theory? I take it back to the dimensions of string theory and just how evidential do we...
Okay. That's a very good question, because a lot of people confuse this nine-dimensional model of the physics of the universe with string theory. It is true that string theory is a subset, but is only a subset. So, for example, if physicists were to prove that all the string theories are wrong, the nine-dimensional model still holds. It just means we've got some other way of dealing with the physics in nine space dimensions.
Is anybody going to ever get a Nobel Prize for it? Because Nobel Prizes are for observational evidence.
Well, I don't think that's going to happen. And by the way, this discovery is now almost 18 years old. So usually they don't wait that long to give out a Nobel Prize. But the work that demonstrates that there must be 6 small dimensions that accompany the 3 large dimensions, it's really the only way that you can have quantum mechanics, general relativity, gravity, and quantum mechanics, did I say that already, coexisting. And so what happened, there was a group at Caltech led by John Schwartz. And incidentally, his research team involved a former member of this class, who's now the chairman of the physics department at Baylor University. That was Jerry Cleaver. And so I actually consulted with Jerry Cleaver in writing that chapter in Beyond the Cosmos. But the fact is, for light to be possible, you have to have quantum mechanics, gravity, and general relativity all coexisting. There's no other way you can have physical life existing. And to have those coexist, you have to have 6 small dimensions accompany the 3 large ones. And when John Schwartz and his team of graduate students first began to work on this, they said, well, it's got to be either 8 dimensions, 9 dimensions, 10, 11. They went all the way up to 26. And it took about 10 years of theoretical work to rule out all those possible dimensional realms and say it's 9. 9 is the only one that actually allows all the symmetries that are demanded by quantum mechanics and gravity to coexist. So that's secure. And by the way, that as a corollary to getting quantum mechanics and gravity to coexist, they demonstrated that that model alone would have predicted the theory of general relativity independent of Albert Einstein. And so that was given as additional confirmation that this model indeed is correct. But is there any observational support to prove the model? No. And will there ever be any observational support to prove the model? The answer, again, is no. The reason why is that these 6 tiny dimensions are extremely tiny. A good way to visualize the 6 extra dimensions is you've got length, width, and height. Those are the large dimensions, the dimensions that are still expanding as the universe gets older and older. The 6 other dimensions, by the way, were expanding when the universe was created. So the picture is this. God creates the universe with 9 dimensions of space. They all expand at the same rate from the cosmic creation event. But once gravity separates out from the other forces of physics, 6 of the 9 dimensions stop expanding. So so they're the same size today as when gravity separated out from the other forces of physics, which means that these dimensions are the size they were when the universe was 1/100,000th of a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second old. And you say, how big are these dimensions? Well, a good way to visualize it again is to think of them as very tightly wrapped up scrolls around the three big dimensions, which kind of explains why we don't notice them. Because if you were to take, say, a piece of paper, well, I can kind of visualize it with this. Take a piece of paper like this, two dimensions. If I roll it up very tightly as a scroll, those two dimensions will appear to you to be a single line. And that basically explains why we don't notice them, because the six small dimensions are wrapped up as scrolls very tightly around the three big dimensions. Now, this team at Caltech calculated what the cross-section of the scroll is. The cross-section of the scroll is 20 orders of magnitude smaller than the diameter of an electron. So that's why we have no hope of ever detecting those dimensions. I mean, so you say, what's 20 orders of magnitude? Let me see if I can work it out. That's
it won't matter.
It won't matter. Let's see. That's 1/100,000,000th of a trillionth smaller than the diameter of an electron. Yes.
Is this integrated somehow with hyperinflation?
The inflation event happens quite a bit later. Okay. This event where the six of the nine dimensions stop expanding happens when the universe is 10^-43 seconds old. The inflation event happens between 10^-34 and 10^-35 seconds. And that's when the strong nuclear force separates out from the other forces of physics. And by the way, if you want to, I got asked this question a lot at the AMP conference. What's going on with unified field theory? And a good way to visualize it is to think what happens to a bar magnet when you heat it up. If you heat up a bar magnet, the magnetism disappears. Now, it really doesn't disappear. What happens is that the heat energy and the magnetic energy blend. And when you cool the magnet, they separate, where you get heat energy and magnetic energy. The same thing happens with the expanding universe. When the universe is created with these nine dimensions of space, you only have one force of physics. And at 10^-43 seconds, gravity separates out from what's called the strong electroweak force. That's three forces of physics blended together. At the inflation event, the strong nuclear force separates out from the electroweak force. And at about 10^-17 seconds, that's when the weak nuclear force separates out from the electromagnetic force. And from that point onward, the universe has four forces of physics. But when it's very young, it's very hot. And the hotter the universe, that's going to bring about the unification. Now, what has happened observationally is physicists have used these powerful particle accelerators like the one in Switzerland and France, where they duplicate the temperature conditions when the universe was very young. And they have been able to duplicate that moment when the electromagnetic force separates out from the weak nuclear force. That's been fully resolved. So there we know the unified field theory that Einstein spent the last part of his career searching for. We now have experimental observational evidence that all that is correct. But every time a force separates out, you get what's called symmetry breaking. Something strange happens, like the inflation event, like the stopping of the expansion of six dimensions of space. So, but what this tells us in terms of apologetics is the God that created the universe is a God that's more powerful than nine dimensions of space. It's a God that can operate in nine dimensions of space. And since he created those space-time dimensions, he can do it without those space-time dimensions, which is why I said at the AMP conference, there's multiple ways God can resolve the problem of human free will and divine predestination. And in my book, I think we have the book over there, I give you three different ways it can be done. But given that God transcends the universe and he can create space-time dimensions at will, how he's got millions, if not an infinite number of ways he can resolve human free will and divine predestination. What I simply do in the book is show you it's not a contradiction. You don't have to appeal to middle knowledge, for example, to resolve free will and predestination. You can do it simply by realizing how big God must be. And by the way, this happens in physics all the time, where we run into things that look contradictory, but once we get a smaller perspective on it, or a bigger perspective on it, it gets resolved. And it's happened every time in the discipline of physics. Every time we've seen a crisis, we've been able to resolve it simply by changing, either reducing or expanding our perspective. And my point is, you can do the same theologically. By the way, that was part of my conversion experience, is realizing of all the world's holy books, the Bible was the only one that taught doctrines that can't be understood in the context of length, width, height, and time. Of course, what I found in all the other holy books was a set of doctrines that could be comprehended within length, width, height, and time. And as a 17-year-old, that persuaded me these other books come from human beings. The Bible potentially could come from a being that transcends. Well, it did come from a being that transcends our space-time dimensions. My next quest was, okay, is this a book that comes from the demonic realm, or does it come from God himself? And realizing everything that it said was true and correct, I said, this is actually from God. But my first step was realizing we definitely can rule out a purely human origin, because it gives us teachings, doctrines about God that cannot be comprehended within the dimensions we human beings can visualize and experience. Yes?
Lynn, I don't know if you read the Quran when you were going through all those things. I'm trying to get through it, but what do these scholars say, and whatever, that when they look at the science, and how do they apologize for it?
Well, there's a book in my office written by a Muslim apologist called Maurice Bakai. He's a medical doctor, and he's written a book on the Quran, the Bible, and science. And basically what he tries to do in that book is show you all the scientific errors of the Bible and all the places that the Quran got the science right. But if you read the book, his critique of the Bible is basically his insistence that the Bible teaches young earth creationism. And we know that's nonsense scientifically, so we can't trust the Bible. And what does he do with the Quran? Well, he'll say the Quran predicts that men would go to the moon and walk on the surface of the moon. But if you actually check the Quranic text, what Maurice Mackay has done is found a section in the Quran where it mentions man here, and three pages over here it mentions moon. And it claims that they're connected, but there's...
I don't even know how they come up with these things.
Well, it's a classic case of apologetic eisegesis. Figure out what you want to say, and then search through the whole Quran and see if you can find a word here, a word there, and link them together.
Isn't crazy?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm going crazy.
So, well, this is why William Campbell, who is a Christian medical doctor, wrote a response book. And it's got a similar title about, the Bible and the Quran in light of science and history. And we sold the book as long as we could. The reason why we can't sell the book anymore, the Muslims have sued William because they said he quoted too much from the Quran. And so they're suing him. Right. Well, I mean, there is this rule that, technically he could win in court because the laws state that if it's more than 75 years old, then it's no longer under copyright. So, but the problem is he doesn't have the money that these Muslims have, and he just says, I can't fight the court battle. And so they kind of compromised, and he just agreed not to sell the book anymore. So, but that's a standard Islamic approach, is to use threats. So, but we do have, I think we got two copies left.
Go to court since it's over 75 years and a discussion, right?
Well, I don't know all the details, but I do know that the book has been taken out of print. Well, we want to keep one. So,
There's your fundraiser.
But no, I'll tell you what. There we go. You want to pay off our building and get everything equipped, we'll give you our last copy of William Campbell's book. But I'll tell you what William Campbell does, and I think there's other ways to solve the problem. He basically says, okay, what they're doing is they're cherry picking through the book, the Quran, and trying to cook together these words. But he says there's multiple clear statements in the Quran where we can show it got the science wrong and it got the history wrong. I mean, I'll give you one example. This is one I discovered many decades ago, is that what you see in the Quran is that the gestation period for the human female is 6 months. And when I saw that, I said, well, the Quran must have been written by a man because a woman wouldn't have said that. And, you know, it talks, as an astronomer I read it, it talks about the seven spheres of heaven. And, you know, one sphere's got stars in it, one sphere's got planets, and these are concentric spheres. And it's like, this can't possibly be right. It actually implies that the stars are closer to us than the planets. You know, that can't be right. Now, I've talked to Muslim apologists about that, and they say, well, that's all figurative. It's not literal. And I says, well, what are you going to do about these other texts? And so, but again, for me, what struck me the first time I picked up the Quran was how little content it had and how repetitious it was and how hard it was trying to sound spiritual. I mean, over and over again, you see statements like how great God is, how merciful God is, how powerful God is, and keeps repeating God's name. And it's like, you know, I get this literally every paragraph. And it kind of reminds me of the passage where we're told, you know, avoid repetitive prayers. And so that's what, in fact, of all the holy books I picked up, the Quran was by far the most repetitive. But I think there's some context for that because, you know, serious Muslims are exhorted to memorize the entire Quran. Well, given how repetitious it is, it's not that difficult to memorize it from cover to cover. But the other thing that struck me is just how content light it was. I mean, here I was a science student trying to go through and say, okay, what historical statements can I pick out of here and scientific statements I can pick and put it to the test? Well, everything was so vaguely written that it was quite challenging to find passages. I had to search through quite, oh, here's one about women's gestation period. Here's one about these spheres. But what William Campbell has done is he's documented all the historical and scientific errors. And he says these are legitimate errors because they're all stated in one sentence. It's not like you're pulling a word here and a word there. It's right in a single sentence. And does this repeatedly, not just for history, but also for science.
How did you read your Quran since you didn't know Arabic?
Well, I read it in English.
Oh.
And that's a common Islamic response. Well, of course, you're critiquing the English translation. The only way you can really understand the Quran is to read it in Arabic. But... you know, you got it in Arabic right there, all right? It's in English. So, yeah. But the whole point, the way I respond to that is, look, we translate the Bible from Greek into English, Greek into Arabic, Hebrew into Arabic, and it's a reasonably accurate translation. It shouldn't be that difficult to take it from Arabic and put it into English. The languages aren't that different. But that's their way out. And what you heard from Abdu Murray is that Muslims are insistent that the Bible's been corrupted and that the manuscript evidence is really bad. But the opposite, and this is something William Campbell also brings out, is that when it comes to the Bible, there is no better manuscript evidence for any book in existence, period. It's overwhelmingly better than any other ancient text, literally by orders of magnitude. You know, and Abdu Murray gave an example, you know, how we have the account of Alexander the Great. I think an even better example is the account we have of the Punic Wars. And we have five manuscripts of the Punic Wars. And the earliest of those manuscripts is 9th century AD. But because of the weight and the consistency of these five manuscripts, we believe that the historical context of what we see in those manuscripts accurately depicts what happened in 2 and 300 BC in the war between Carthage and Rome. And nobody disputes it because of the fact we got five manuscripts. when it comes to the New Testament, the earliest manuscripts go back to the 3rd century B.C., complete manuscripts, A.D., and we have 16,000 manuscripts of the New Testament. And of those 16,000 manuscripts, the differences account to 40 words. Only 40 words have any differences. And usually they're prepositions and articles. None of them are significant words where there's a difference. And Gary Habermas was mentioning yesterday, we have fragments. Those are 16,000 complete manuscripts. We have fragments that literally date back to just years after they were written, less than 10 years after they were written. And therefore, there's really no rational historical basis for doubting the accuracy of what we have in the Old and New Testament. By the way, the Old Testament is not quite as strong on the manuscript evidence, but one reason why we believe the Old Testament is also highly reliable and uncorrupted is that until 60 years ago, the earliest manuscript we had of the Old Testament was 9th century A.D., until they found the Dead Sea Scrolls, which were 2nd century B.C., and they compared the 2nd century B.C. Old Testament with the 9th century A.D. Old Testament, virtually identical. And so what it reveals is how carefully the Jewish scribes maintained the integrity of their texts. And they've since discovered that when scribes were making a copy of an Old Testament book, there would be one young scribe. They always picked the young scribe to do the transcription. I'm old enough now that my handwriting is a little bit shaky, okay? So they always picked a young scribe. But they had four older scribes who were experienced, two on one shoulder and two on the other shoulder, watching every little letter that he would put on the piece of a scroll. And if that young man made a mistake, it had to be recorded in the margin. He had to sign that he made a mistake, and the four older scribes had to initial that that indeed was an error. And so this explains why 11 centuries go by and the scrolls are virtually identical. Yes?
They also, let's say you copy the book of Isaiah, they would count, putting it in English terms, they would count the number of times the letter A appeared, D appeared, C, 3C. And then when they, in the old copy, new copy, they count the number of times A appeared, B appeared, C appeared. And they'd count the middle verse, the middle letter, and so on of the whole book. And if there were more than three mnemonics, were off by more than three times, they threw out the whole book.
Right. Had to start over again.
But you said within a few years, the Mark manuscript that was being debated that goes back to about 69 or 60, has that been verified?
Well, okay, there's small fragments of Matthew, small fragments of Mark that go back to about 60 A.D., which means you're looking at just a decade between when they were written and when you actually have manuscript evidence. Now, the reason why I made the comment I did is they carbon 14 dated it, but because all you got is a small fragment, your date is like plus or minus 2 or 3 years. Now, if you have a large piece, you can get a date that's accurate to plus or minus 8 or 9 months. But that requires having a whole page. And so these very early fragments that they have that date within a few years of when the text most likely was originally penned, you're looking at fragments that are about this big. So they might have, maybe 10 words on it, and that's it. And to carbon 14 date it, what you do is you kind of take the little bits and pieces where there's no writing, but now you're looking at just small pieces of the papyrus.
Right. So with John Bodmer of John.
Oh, with John, you're in better shape, because with John, we actually have whole pages that date within a few years of when John most likely wrote the Gospel of John and the Revelation and some of his letters. So, there you're looking at, again, less than 10 years. But the book of John was probably written in the early 90s, and they got fragments. The biggest one they got that's very accurately dated is 119 A.D., but they got fragments that date earlier than that. Now, this contrasts with the Quran, where there's a 300-year gap between the earliest manuscript and when it most likely was put down. And keep in mind, Muhammad was not literate. So he did not write the Quran. It was written after him. And there's a big debate as to when it would have been originally penned. You know, that date is plus or minus 20 or 30 years. Then you've got 300 years after that. So as William Campbell points out, and as many other scholars have pointed out, it's the exact opposite of what Muslims claim, is that we have really shaky manuscript evidential support for the Quran. And as you look at the Quran over the centuries, there's dramatic differences between Qurans that date back 1,000 years and what the Quran looks like today. Or even over the last 200 years, you see significant changes. Whereas we don't see that in the Old New Testament. The Old Testament manuscripts that date back to the 3rd, 4th, and 5th century, they're identical to what we see in print today. Yes?
We hear this argument, the Bible's just this hodgepodge of, like the telephone game, you're whispering around the room, you know, and methods of God altered. Can you recommend a book or a paper that really documents the reliability of the Bible?
Yeah, probably the classic one is by F.F. Bruce. You know, really thick book on...
M. Bruce.
F.F. Bruce.
F.F. Bruce.
Yes. That's the classic. And if you want more of a lay version, dating back to roughly the same time, Josh McDowell's book, Evidence That Demands a Verdict.
Okay.
Not Volume 1. You want Volume 2. Volume 2 really goes into the documentary evidence for the Old New Testament. And so that's kind of a lay version and a condensation of what F.F. Bruce wrote. But there's also some more modern texts. In fact, Gary Habermas referred to some of them yesterday. There's some works that actually add to the scholarship of F.F. Bruce and actually takes into account these fragments that have been discovered in the last 10 years. Because you won't find that in F.F. Bruce's book. You need to find it in the more. But these are more like articles that are published in theological journals. So, again, somebody needs to do an update of F.F. Bruce's book. So, but it's a book about that thick. Yes.
Gary Habermas yesterday was talking about these creeds, gospel creeds. He went all the way back to the year 30 to 33 A.D. And I'm not too familiar with
What he's referring to is a passage in 1 Corinthians 15. You know, where you got Paul making a creedal statement, and he says that this creedal statement predated his conversion. And so, given what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, that means that the church already had, as one of their creedal statements, that Jesus was crucified, died, and resurrected bodily from the dead. And so, what Gary did yesterday is you go through the book of Acts and calculate when the conversion of Paul took place. And Saul became Paul roughly 2 to 3 years after the crucifixion of Jesus. So it means that the creeds were out already in place in the Christian church and less than 2 years after the event took place.
Do we have any of the fragments or anything in writing?
We have nothing in writing from that period. But he says we have very good manuscript support for the book of Acts. No one refuted Paul's claim that he made. And this is one thing. You know, when people write a book that gets that much public attention and is written at the time when they're eyewitnesses to the various events that are still alive, and you've got critics, and, you know, the whole point is, the New Testament was birthed at a time of significant Jewish and Roman assault on the Christian faith. Which means that if there was any opportunity or any possibility of, attacking the credibility and the integrity of the text, you would have seen it in Jewish and Roman writings. And you don't see that at all. What you see from the Jewish and Roman historians is actually documenting that indeed these historical events that you see recorded in the book of Acts really did happen. And by the way, there was a classic work written more than 100 years ago, where three atheist lawyers wanted to demonstrate that the resurrection never happened and the events in the book of Acts never happened. And they said, we're all trial lawyers. we're going to put this to the same rigor of attack that we would do in a trial case. And they wound up writing a book where they concluded that the historical evidence for the bodily resurrection of Jesus from the dead was stronger than the evidence that Napoleon was defeated at Waterloo. And they wrote this book less than 60 years after Napoleon was defeated at Waterloo. So I think that book is out of print, but it was well read during the Victorian era. Yes?
At the time that these were written, like Acts, how widespread was literacy?
How widespread was literacy?
Yeah, was a large percentage of the population read, or was it?
It wouldn't have been the majority of the population, but there was an educated class. There was a university system in place throughout the Roman Empire. So, yeah, you did have literate people. I mean, in the land of Israel, for example, the scribes, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, they were all literate. Anyone who was of the nobility was literate. And there were many literate people besides. Notice, for example, you've got Jesus in the synagogue during his ministry reading from the scroll. Now, that tells you that people who did not go through the university system, many of them were literate. And evidently it was the practice within the Jewish synagogues that people from within the congregation, not the priests, would get up and read from the scroll. So that implies that there would have to be a significant fraction of, quote, common people coming to synagogue who were literate. So literacy, at least in the land of Israel, was quite widespread. I mean, you can understand from the Jewish perspective, they would want people to be able to read these scrolls. And
I
so,
would assume that the Jewish people, they had a wider spread literacy, including down into the lower classes, than other groups.
Well,
would that be true or not?
That is true, although another two groups of people that were quite literate were the Roman aristocracy and the Greek aristocracy. They were also very literate. And a number of common Greek citizens were literate. So, for example, it was a practice of wealthy Romans to hire a Greek to teach their children because the Greeks were educated and they were literate and they wanted their children to be literate. But, for example, what Paul refers to as the barbarians, and by the way, that was not a negative term. It's basically a reference to the lands that the Roman Empire had conquered. So, for example, the Bulgaria region, the Goths, or pardon me, the people living in France, I forget what they were called,
the Gauls.
Yeah, they were referred to as the barbarians, which were basically a reference to the uneducated peoples.
Frisians.
Pardon me?
Frisians.
Yeah, there you go. Yes.
There was a book written about 10 or 12 years ago called Faith on Trial by a woman named Pamela Ewan who did that. She's an attorney and she took a New Testament manuscript and basically made a case for the idea that it would hold up in a court of law if it was ever needed as evidence.
Right, yeah. Those three lawyers that I referred to during the Victorian era, that's been repeated by other lawyers. But that was the first time I can find that there was a legal challenge. Yes. And we want to move on.
I was wondering what the Muslim apologists would say about the verse in the Quran that says Allah is a great deceiver.
Well, this is something that Abdul Murray was pointing out, is that you've got passages in the Quran that contradict one another. You've got passages, for example, that say that Muslims are to get counsel from Jews and Christians, and they're to treat Jews and Christians well. But if you read later on the Quran, you get quite a militant approach towards Jews and Christians. Now, I'll tell you how Muslims handle that. They say the latter parts of the Quran are more inspired than the former parts. But now they've got a problem here, okay? You're claiming that this book is inspired by this being that gave this message to Muhammad, and you're saying that some parts of it are, quote, more inspired than other parts, and the latter parts can cause you to discount the earlier parts. But that basically explains the militancy of Islam. They basically discount the earlier passages of the Quran and focus on the latter passages. That's one thing Abdul Murray was pointing out. You have to realize the Islamic mind thinks differently than the Christian mind. know, our idea is the entire Old New Testament is inspired and inerrant. And they take a different approach than that. And so if you're not aware of that, that can be a problem.
Well, God can contradict himself in Islam. It's called abrogation.
Right.
So the latest statement is the valid one.
And see, that's another similarity with Mormonism, right? Because in Mormonism, they got the same theological perspective that past teachings can be abrogated by future teachings. Yes.
But you also, when you have to know that there's pre-Medina, and when he was in Mecca before he got thrown out, you know, kicked out, he gave all those nice verses. As soon as he was kicked out and went and became a marauder, a bandito, basically, and killed, and then he cut your head off. So that would be later. And the ones that he later talked about, that's the real Islam. And that's what they're doing today. They're following Muhammad to a T.
Well, yeah, if you look at the history of Muhammad, he started off wanting to become a Jew.
Right.
But the Jews rejected him because he was teaching things that were not in line with.
That's why he hates the Jews.
And by the way, he tried to join not Judaism, but an offshoot sect of Judaism. The Jews themselves rejected this Jewish sect that he was trying to become part of. But then he basically applied it to all Jews. So, yeah, it's a complex history. So, yeah, there was a comment here. Yeah.
Abrogation was my comment. I'll just add on to this that around Muhammad's time, the Jewish sect that was rejected was sent out into the desert of Saudi Arabia, and it's thought that maybe they taught him to be.
Yeah, it could
so
be.
Missionaries are important.
Right. And, you know, there's a lot of dispute whether the content in the Quran really did come from Muhammad or from a latter. Because a lot of people think that it came from someone a generation later, maybe even two generations later. Okay, let's move on. Get this into part of our lesson here, right? And I just lost my keynote here. Let me get it back up.
Proverbs 30.
Yeah, we're going to get into Proverbs 30. Before I do that, though, let's see if I can get this. Here we go. It's coming up. It's going to take some time. A couple of you asked me last week, in terms of wrapping up our discussion on the Ice Age cycle, I made repeatedly the comment that ice ages are rare in the history of the Earth, and so you asked me if I could actually show you that graphically. Well, this is the graph that you're seeing come up here. And basically what you're seeing here is that, and by the way, with those lines you see from 3.8 billion years forward, they're actually a little bit narrower than when I got there. I just had a hard time making them exactly the narrow width that they are. But the really big one that you see at about 2.2 to 2.4 billion years after the birth of the Earth, that's what's referred to as the first great oxygenation event. And so that's when oxygen was pumped into the atmosphere and carbon dioxide came out, and that's the biggest ice age the Earth has ever had. Lasted for 250 million years. It's the only one that lasted that long. You got a couple that lasts 15 to 30 million years, just before 4 billion years after the, well, about 600 million years ago, to 750 million years ago. These are ice ages that are consistent with a second great oxygenation event. So let me just kind of go over here. What you have here is oxygen that's way below 1%, then it jumps up to about 2 or 3%, and then comes back down to 1%, and during that time, you've got an ice age because you're pulling carbon dioxide out that cools the Earth, and then you've got this long period here, and what's happening here is the oxygen content goes from 1% up to 8%, and here it goes up to 10%. And once again, you're getting a drawdown of greenhouse gases from the atmosphere, which gives you that significant ice age. The thickest one there is 50 million years wide. The next one is 25 million years wide. The ones that follow thereafter are just 2 to 5 million years wide. And then the one we're in right now, which is at the very end, that's only 2.58 million years, but it's not a true ice age. It's an ice age cycle.
I'm not understanding the graph, I'm afraid, here as to the width of the lines represents a length of an ice age.
Yes.
And then, but the recent ones have been in a cycle where the ice age is much longer than the interglacial, and I don't see that reflected.
Okay. And the last, I mean, I can't show that the resolution isn't that good. So, because even this line here is thicker than 2.5 million years. So I'm showing you the period where we got the ice age cycle, and oh boy.
But isn't the white space in between represent interglacials?
No, those are not interglacials. Okay, what you're seeing here is a period when the Earth has no ice at all.
Right.
So what I'm graphing here for you are those periods of Earth's history where at least 5% of the Earth's surface was covered in ice. And so most of Earth's history, you got no ice at all. There's only brief periods where you got ice. And this last one is the only one where you got an ice age cycle. But this line here is basically showing the entire period where you got an ice age cycle. And the reason why I can get away with that is that even when we're in a warm interglacial, 10% of the surface of the Earth is covered in ice. During this ice age cycle, we go from 10% to 25%. So during an ice age, it's 25%, and during the warm interglacial, it's 10%. So that's where it's going from 10 up to 25.
Is that last line then is representing the entire ice age cycle that you've been talking about?
It's the entire ice age cycle, the entire 2.58 million years.
And where we are is right at the trailing edge of that.
We're right at the trailing edge of that. That's the present era right there.
So that present cycle has been lasting for two, the last line represents 2.8 million years?
Represents 2.58 million years. I mean, the ice age cycle, let me see if I can pull it up here for you. Oh boy, let me. Sorry about this, it keeps wanting. Ah. Okay, that's the ice ages in Earth's history. What the ice age cycle looks like right now is a 100,000 year period, where you basically got 90,000 years of ice and then a warm interglacial. And that's a segue to two papers that were published just this week in Science. So, hey, we're living in a time when it actually fits in with our lesson. And what I've been sharing with you is that you see right now we have a very stable climate phase, and we're right now sitting about 4 degrees centigrade below the maximum. And what you see in previous ice age cycles, when it hits that maximum, you get a rapid drop in temperature. Now, you've heard in the news that global warming is happening, and the temperature is actually rising from 4 degrees centigrade from the maximum, and it's creeping up. And what we've seen in previous ice age cycles is when it hits that maximum, you get a rapid drop into an ice age. What these two papers are pointing out, we may already be seeing that happening, in the sense that we see the warming of the planet, and one of the consequences of the warming of the planet is that the Arctic ice cap is now half the size it was when I was born. So just in my lifetime, it's shrunk by a factor of two. It's such that you can send oil tankers over the Northwest Passage. When I was a child being educated, I was taught about all these historians trying to find the Northwest Passage, and every time they did, they got stuck in ice. There was just no way to get through. Now it's quite easy to get through. However, the melting of all that Arctic ice has changed the climate of the Arctic. And what these two papers are pointing out is that we think we're seeing two phenomena. One is a flow of Arctic air in the wintertime down into Western Europe and the eastern U.S. And notice that the last three winters have been especially severe, both in Western Europe and the U.S. The other paper is pointing out we're now measuring increased snowfall over Siberia. Now, what's driving that increased snowfall is you've got sunlight, instead of impinging on ice and being reflected away, it's impinging on liquid water and being absorbed. And impinging on liquid water and being absorbed, that means you get more water vapor into the atmosphere, which causes more snow to fall over Siberia, And the big fear is it could start falling over Canada. As I've mentioned before, the reason why we don't have ice over Siberia and Canada is because both Canada and Siberia are virtual deserts. Northern Canada and Siberia get less than 10 inches of precipitation a year. And because they get so little, the snow can't accumulate to make an ice cap. But if you were to double that, you get an ice age. And there's some concern that if you melt the polar ice cap, that's what causes all the ice to begin to accumulate. And by the way, what we know from previous ice ages, where it begins to show up first is Siberia and eastern Canada. And then it begins to spread from eastern Canada into western Europe, and eventually covers all of Canada, and even reaches down to Yosemite National Park. So half of California in the last ice age was covered in thousands of feet of ice. Yes. Okay, well, what I've taught on in this class is that you need an ice age cycle to sustain 7 billion human beings with high technology. It's because of the ice age cycle we get a flow of resources into these huge agricultural plains that allows us to sustain that population. It also exposes metal ore deposits that we can mine, fossil fuel deposits. We also wind up with all these lakes. I mean, keep in mind, Canada's got more lakes than the rest of the world combined. That's all thanks to the last ice age. And because of all the lakes you see over Siberia, the Lapland, I mean, if you go to northern Sweden and Norway, again, lots of lakes. Finland, lots of lakes. It's that huge amount of lake coverage that allows those regions to sustain very vibrant forests with so little precipitation. And you've got this system of lakes and rivers. You're going to be getting fog. And I just put some articles on my Facebook page making the point that because, and by the way, you see fog in the book of Job as one of the things that God has blessed us with. And for example, Northern California, a quarter of all the water that is absorbed by the plants doesn't come from rain and snow. It comes from fog. And incidentally, you can thank the redwoods for the fact that Northern California captures so much water from fog. Redwoods literally are at the height that the laws of physics will permit. You cannot grow a tree any taller than a redwood. The tallest redwood is 380 feet tall. There'll never be a taller tree because if you go taller than that, gravity simply will not permit the flow of liquid and nutrients up to the top. It can't happen. And so you've got these redwoods at the extreme limit that the laws of physics will permit. And where do they grow? Along the coast of Northern California. But they provide a barrier that captures the fog and brings, you know, liquid down into the root system of the plants. And I grew up in coastal British Columbia. You're from Trail. You know about fog. And if the fog can get so thick that when you come in the house, water is literally dripping off your clothes and your shoes are soaked. You haven't been walking in anything wet, but the fog can get literally that thick. If you got nice tall trees, that can capture a lot of that.
Divine
so,
order.
Pardon me?
I said divine order.
Well, that's something we taught when we were in the book of Job. Remember we had that little exercise? We went through Job 37 and 38. We counted 16 different ways that God, 16 different forms that God brings water to the plants of the continental land masses. He gives us snow, he gives us hail, he gives us frost, he gives us dew, he gives us fog, he gives us rain, he gives us torrential rains, he gives us mist, all these different forms of precipitation, he gives us frozen ice, and all those different forms of precipitation give us a reliable, long-lasting water supply so we can grow all these crops. For example, California would not be able to grow food if we didn't have 30 feet of snow falling every winter on the Sierra Nevada mountains. And one thing you know about snow is it melts slowly. and so it provides a nice steady flow of water. And wherever you see a permanent stream or river here in California, you know it's being fed by snow and ice. So there was one up, somebody was from Mount Baldy. Don't we have this guy from Mount Baldy?
Right.
Okay. There's a waterfall a little bit east of Mount Baldy. It flows all year long.
Pretty much.
But that's because of the snow that rests on Mount Baldy. Take away that snow, it would not be flowing year-round. Hey, let me make one closing statement here. These two papers that are published about the fact that we may actually beginning to see the signs that we could soon enter into a new ice age, both papers are tentative. They're saying we have measurements that indicate we may be seeing accumulation of snow in Siberia, but it's not yet proven. And likewise, they're saying we are seeing the last 3 years this change in the polar airflow from the Arctic. We think that it might be permanent, but we can't prove that it's permanent. It's only been 3 years in a row. And yeah, it's getting warmer here in California, but it's only been going on for the past 3 years. So
weather cycles are very complex.
They're very complex.
Even with our supercomputers, they're not powerful enough to figure this out.
Right. So this is all tentative, but it's the first time I've seen the scientific literature that there may actually be some evidence to sustain what we've been seeing here, is when the temperature spikes, it actually can bring about cold rather than additional warm.
Could that mean the end of the world as we know it?
No. Let me end with this positive statement. I think what this is telling us is that God is going to be sustaining the stable climate that we've been enjoying for the past 9,000 years for only a short period of time. I'd say a maximum of maybe 1,000 to 1,500 years. But, and I'm premillennial, so that means Christ is going to be ruling for 1,000 years here on earth.
Right.
Which means we haven't got a whole lot of time to fulfill the Great Commission. Or to put another way, I believe that God in the next few decades is going to equip those of us who are serious about fulfilling the Great Commission with all the tools we need to do it so we can hasten the return of Christ. So I'm excited about these discoveries. Because I think we're living in a time when God's going to be pouring out His Spirit upon us and performing miracles. And, you know, often miracles are kind of like the one I experienced yesterday where, you know, God just causes somebody to ask the right question at the right time to give me a perfect opportunity. That's a miracle. I think God's going to do that because the miracles that God's most intent on are miracles that bring people to faith in Jesus Christ. Because God's goal is that there be billions of people in a new creation. That's why He gave us the Ice Age cycle, so that the planet could sustain billions of people, because God wants the new creation to be filled with lots of believers, not just a few million. He wants billions there. He wants tens of billions there. And He's designed everything to make that possible. Let me pray. Father in heaven, we thank You for the privilege of living in the 21st century. Lord, we can see that Your hand is at work to bring about the completion of the task that You've given us to perform, namely to take the good news of salvation through Jesus Christ to all the people groups of the world, to all the tribes of the world. Thank You, Lord, for the message we heard yesterday about how our own nation, the United States, is filled with thousands of tribes, whether they be computer programmers or accountants or trial lawyers. Lord, You've blessed us with tribes. Help us, Lord, to reach each of those tribes so that significant numbers of them will become followers of You. And, Lord, we can hasten the day when we leave this creation and enter into a brand new creation. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.